Well, good morning, everyone. Everyone can hear me okay in the back? Lee? Good. So it's karaoke time. I take requests. Gigi Papa, yes. Well, here we are. Another beautiful day here at Loon Lake. And I hope it's beautiful wherever you are, people on the Zoom in different places. I was just outside a few minutes before coming in to the Zendo, seeing the mist rising off the lake, the trees gradually getting brighter in the sun. And again, I was just struck how beautiful this world is. And made a kind of vow to myself to remember, to appreciate this great gift that we have, this world, the beauty that is there. And maybe a little less kvetching about my life and the people around me and stuff. Turn towards the beauty. So I hope everyone is enjoying the session so far. The food is being delicious. I hope you're getting some sleep. And also some time outdoors to enjoy this beautiful place. So I thought I'd start off with a confession. I hate making mistakes. Maybe that's a bit too strong. I dislike strongly making mistakes. I think I have an aversion to making mistakes. Perhaps it is a mild aversion of a telephobia, a fear of imperfection. That's another word you can pack away, a telephobia. And, of course, I immediately started the session by making a mistake. The first morning I was doing the kind of morning greeting, I started to go the wrong way around the Zendo. And Kate very kindly indicated I go the other way. So I read, you know, a brief article about a telephobia. And it said someone who has that condition may be or can be kind of terrified of making mistakes to the extent that they avoid any situation where they feel they won't succeed. Well, I've had that experience, trying to avoid a situation where I don't think I'm going to succeed. And of course, a telephobia can lead to anxiety, depression, low self-esteem, all those other things. And in contrast to that, we read in the Vimalakirti Sutra that this layperson, Vimalakirti, is famous for his ability to use upaya, or to use skillful means, in any situation. And I realized, I bet he doesn't have any trouble with a telephobia, right? He knows what to do. And haven't we all longed at times for that particular ability of upaya or skillful means to be steady in the presence of our life? So consciously or unconsciously, I'm sure we have all asked ourselves, how do I say the right thing now? Do the right action, bring into being the right wisdom and compassion called for this situation. How do I act in this painful situation? This one that maybe I'm really afraid of. How do I fix this tense and a difficult conflict that I find myself in? And oh, how do I avoid making a mistake? You know, this session is a great place for bringing that forward. For those of us here at Loon Lake doing jobs for the first time, or maybe even doing jobs for the 10th time, I think that question looms large, right? I don't want to make a mistake ringing the bell, making an announcement, cooking the food, chopping the vegetables, tying my knot on the odioki. Right. Now, in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, there is the image of the two wings of awakening, wisdom and compassion. And although we may have some idea of what that means, wisdom and compassion, really bringing those to bear on a troubling situation in our life is not so easy. Real life situations can challenge our commitment to wisdom and compassion when we try with the best of intentions to respond, and yet we only fail. We fail to bring ease, perhaps, or perhaps our efforts even make the situation worse. Burned by past situations that we have found ourselves in, we become fearful of making a mistake. So we might retreat just into silence when actually words are called for. Or we might do nothing, decide that's the best thing to do nothing, when a kind action, a touch, a hug, would bring relief and ease. Or maybe we just become kind of stuck in self-blame, a sense of unworthiness, inability. So as we learned during this practice period, Vimalakirti is famous for his use of upaya. An upaya is a Sanskrit word, often translated as skillful means, or skill in means, or expedient means. There's various ways to really translate that word. The sense is that through a practice, understanding, view, statement, etc., that although a practice or view or statement is not ultimately true in the highest sense of the word, it can still be beneficial to do or to hold. So there's actually two senses I'm going to be talking about this upaya. So this is the first one. So in the sutra, we find that Vimalakirti participates in all levels of society. He teaches the Dharma directly or indirectly to everyone, no matter what walk of life they're from. Gambling dens, administrators, business people, monks, etc. He tailors the teachings to each audience. So one meaning of upaya is, you know, the kind of tailoring of the teachings to the audience's ability to understand. And this makes total sense in the Buddhist tradition, because from the very beginning, from the time of the Buddha, the Buddhist teachings were understood not as dogma. They are not creeds of things we need to accept and believe. They are not statements of the absolute truth of things. They're simply guides to help each awaken to their deepest nature. So the language Vimalakirti probably used to guide those in a tavern was not the same language he used to teach the young monks or his business associates. Even in the earliest Buddhist texts that we have, we find the Buddha likened his teachings to a raft. He said, once the river has crossed and the far shore of awakening is reached, the raft should be abandoned. In other words, the teachings used to reach the goal are not intrinsically valuable in themselves, but worthwhile to the extent that they help us attain awakening. And I think this is really one of the most challenging aspects of the Buddhist teachings for us to really accept. Because don't we want to be told the final and complete truth? We want an end to the uncertainty of our life. Sorry. Come to the wrong place. The Buddhist teaching, the Buddhist tradition, does not offer us a final ontology of the true and real nature of reality. It doesn't. It does offer, however, skillful teachings, a way for each of us to become fully alive, for each of us to really take our place in the world. And perhaps the most famous example or story that illustrates this upaya is in, of course, the Lotus Sutra. A merchant returning from a trip abroad arrives home to find his house is ablaze. And when he looks in through the big, wide, open door, this is in India, of course, he sees his children in the far back of the house playing. And they're oblivious to the flames that are consuming the house around them. So he calls out to his children, but they ignore his pleas to leave the house because they're so engrossed in their games, they don't want to stop. So in desperation, he calls out that he has brought each of them wondrous gifts. And the children, hearing this, are excited, and they run out of the house and, of course, escape the flames. Now, there's much more to this story. I'm not going to go into the details of this, but I think you get the idea. And you might think, you know, at first glance, oh, wait a minute, the skillful means, it seems like a kind of slippery slope, right? In which the ends justifies the means kind of thing. But I think our bodhisattva vows, our commitment to benefit all beings, really helps us temper any application of skillful means to avoid harmful or self-centered actions. But of course, we have to always be careful. We have to be aware of that possibility. I came across a poem the other day, a delightful poem. Kate and I occasionally read poems to each other, and this one was a discovery from that. And I think it very playfully illustrates the learning of skillful means. So the poem's called Facts of Life by a poet named Ron Wallace. She wonders how people get babies. Suddenly, vague and distracted, we talk about making love. She's six and unsatisfied. Finds our limp answers unpersuasive. Embarrassed, we stiffen and try again. This time, exposing the stark, naked words. Penis, vagina, sperm, boom, and egg. She thinks we're pulling her leg. We decide that it's time to get passionate and insistent. But she's angry, disgusted. Why do we make fun of her? Why do we lie? We sigh. We try cabbages, storks. She smiles. That's more like it. We talk on into the night, trying magic seeds, good fairies, God. That's the poem. Our Buddhist ancestors understood that upaya is really necessary for us. It's necessary because to cut through our delusions, our self-centeredness, is really an arduous task. One filled with obstacles. Remember, the Buddha, after achieving full awakening, strongly considered not trying to teach anyone what he had discovered. He was convinced few people would be able to accept or understand what he came to see. He contemplated simply living out his life without the burden of teaching others. In one of the texts in the early, in the Pali Canon, or the earliest collection of Buddhist writings, here's what the Buddha apparently thought. Enough now with teaching what only with difficulty I reached. This Dharma is not easily realized by those overcome with aversion and passion. What is obtuse, subtle, deep, hard to see, going against the flow, those delighting in passion, choked in the mass of darkness, won't see. So at that point, he almost threw in the towel. But then, fortunately for us and for many others who came before us, he was convinced finally. And there's various legends about how he was convinced. One was the god Indra came down. At any rate, he was convinced that there are those who would listen and take up the practice. And he began then to teach for 40 years, the rest of his life. And we are the beneficiaries of that teaching today. Now, this kind of strong emphasis on upaya in the Buddhist tradition really began around the dawn of the Common Era as a kind of practice, as a quality to cultivate. This was the time when the Buddhist tradition was changing. From a monastic focus to one that was really much more inclusive of laity, lay people, and with this bodhisattva ideal becoming central. Now, earlier I mentioned upaya has the sense of tailoring the teaching to the listener. We see in the Vimalakirti Sutra, however, that there is another meaning of upaya that comes forward and is quite strong. Upaya is the capacity to bring insight about the non-dual nature of reality, that profound interbeing of all things, to bear on our everyday entanglements, the challenges of our life. In other words, it is the ability to effectively apply wisdom and compassion to the messiness of this life. Our life, after all, is full of unseen and difficult circumstances. Anyone who has been tenzo or worked in the kitchen knows this in their bones. One year, I was tenzo here at Loon Lake when we had a very strong storm. And this was probably 10, 15 years ago. We've been here a long time, more. Anyway, in those days, the facilities were rustic. The utilities were undeveloped. So in that strong storm, the power went out suddenly. No lights, no electric rice cookers, no electric ovens, no heat. And there was a backup generator, but the caretaker was away for that day, and nobody knew how to get it going. And dinner was due in a couple of hours. Fortunately, the kitchen at that time at least had a propane range and oven. They were small, however. But with the help of headlamps, flashlights, and a pared-down menu, we managed to get everyone fed. And I was thinking, you know, this is an example of how one stable world can suddenly veer to the right or veer to the left. In those moments, how do you respond? How do you respond? How often, in small and great ways, that sudden veering to the left or right appears in our relationships, in our work, in our health? How do you respond? Can in those very moments, can we be aware of the emptiness, the non-dual nature of all things? And from that place, can we respond? Can we respond with that wide vision? It's not about me. Many have called Buddhism pragmatic or practical, because in most streams of the Buddhist tradition, the focus is on the difficulties of this life rather than on the hereafter. The tradition offers practices and views that can bring some ease, comfort, and insight into the here and now. The great layperson of Vimalakirti, if you remember, was a husband, a father, a merchant, a person of wealth who used his riches to help the poor, etc., etc. He entered gambling dens, taverns, financial centers, freely meeting and talking with all social classes. He also served as a government official. In other words, Vimalakirti, like you and me, had to deal with the trials and tribulations of a busy, hectic, everyday life. The sutra tells us that he was most skillful in each of his many endeavors, while constantly awakening and benefiting the beings that he encountered. So Vimalakirti clearly lived among the delusions of the world without getting ensnared by them. We might say he was in the world, but not of it. He was able to avoid getting trapped by the worldly desires, but not shunning them, not pushing them away. And I think Vimalakirti showed through his life that we don't have to renounce the world in the way commonly thought, becoming a hermit, going off to a cave. He didn't renounce in that way. There's one humorous story in the sutra that I find quite kind of delightful, where Vimalakirti accepts 12,000 divine maidens as a gift. That Mara, the tempter, had brought with him to tempt another practitioner. And Vimalakirti said, well, you can't give them to him. He's a monk, but I'll take them. 12,000 divine maidens. And then Vimalakirti instructs the 12,000 divine maidens in the Dharma. He teaches them the Dharma. And then returns them back to Mara's realm to teach others who are residing in Mara's realm. The last thing Mara would want, right? Kind of like a Trojan horse, but going in there. So before they leave, Vimalakirti tells the divine maidens that each one of them is a lamp that will light 100 other lamps. And so the Dharma will be spread. An example of skillful means by Mara. So though the sutra does have some great stories around skillful means, it offers no detailed formulas or techniques for how to respond to the challenges that life presents us. Our hope for a fix, a deep and penetrating insight that will smooth out the rough and painful aspects of this life, that's missing from Vimalakirti's wise words. We cannot know ahead of time how to respond skillfully to a given situation with an assurance that all will be well in the end. We cannot know what our actions will result in. Responding skillfully in this ever-changing world is learned in part through trial and error, with the understanding that the choice made in one situation may not be appropriate in another, even though the situations are similar. No one, except maybe Vimalakirti, is impervious to the great forces of ambiguity and uncertainty. Each choice includes a risk. And to engage with risk requires us to be willing to face failure and the consequence of that choice. In verse, Vimalakirti sings of the connection between wisdom and skillful means. In the short poem, he says, "Wisdom is the bodhisattva mother's, as the bodhisattva's mother, skillful means their father. Of those who guide and teach all beings, there are none not born of these." Let me read that one more time. Wisdom is the bodhisattva's mother. Skillful means their father. Of those who guide and teach all beings, there are none not born of these. A little bit later, Vimalakirti says, "Wisdom without skillful means is bondage. Wisdom with skillful means is liberation. Skillful means without wisdom is bondage. Skillful means with wisdom is liberation." And wisdom doesn't mean knowing what's the right thing to do. That's not wisdom in this context. Wisdom in this case is the broad and deep seeing of the present situation. It is an awareness of the present, of the presence of the intricacies, even when we're not consciously able to list them. I would say wisdom is the acknowledgement that there is more to this than I'm seeing in this moment. It is the ability, as Norman has written about, to use our imagination to stretch beyond what our immediate, perhaps knee-jerk reaction may be. The Zen tradition encourages us to cultivate what's often called don't know mind. In the famous koan from the Book of Serenity, there's this little dialogue. The monk Fayan was going on pilgrimage, and Master Dijong asked, "Where are you going?" And Fayan said, "On pilgrimage." And Dijong asked, "Why?" And Fayan said, "I don't know." And Dijong replied, "Ah, not knowing is most intimate." The upaya of this not knowing is for you and me to be open, willing to learn, to be surprised, to see and hear others beyond our own ideas. Experience and knowledge, of course, are important, but they can get in the way. Not knowing is a kind of observant humility, which allows us to enter the present moment, engaged, moved, open, most intimate. Sometimes, you know, in a frustrating situation with someone, I remind myself, or at least I try to, that nobody chooses to be a jerk or a bully or worse. Family histories, upbringing, traumatic events, so many causes and conditions, almost all beyond my knowledge, shaped that jerk. So holding this in mind, that in that person are complexities and sufferings that are unseen by me, I ask, okay, how shall I respond? And this is not about capitulation. It's just about a broader awareness. I've told the story several times, I think, but I'm going to tell it again, this story. How several years ago, one of my students at SFU, when I was teaching there, missed almost all of my classes and failed to hand in any assignments. And finally came to see me towards the end of term. And I was in a sour mood, ready to simply fail him. But something in his demeanor moved me. And I coaxed them to tell me what was going on. He told me he was from Syria. He was living in Burnaby with his wife. But the rest of his family and his wife's family were still in Syria. And it had been months since there had been any contact. And this was when the Syrian civil war was raging, the stories of severe human rights abuses, the violence, massacres were in the news. He was distraught. Unable to focus on his studies. So we talked for a while, and we talked about possible options for him. And then he left, and I don't know what happened. I talked with my department head, and we were able to allow SFU to let him withdraw without any kind of penalty. That was one day I was so grateful for my practice. So we cultivate upaya in one way by setting our intentions, carefully considered intentions give us a direction in what otherwise might be an almost aimless life, or a life that is simply shaped by the forces around us. So perhaps you have an intention to go to the gym twice a week, do yoga regularly, work less, do more creative things, buy a house, and all of those are kind of good intentions. Having explicit intentions help us focus on what we consider important rather than being pushed and pulled by the constant grasping for pleasure or the pushing away what's painful. But the Vimalakirti Sutra discusses intentions in a deeper sense, in the sense of vows. Vows are the deep intentions we hold that are unending, that are unfillable. And these vows empower us to choose not to grasp, not to push away, and to return to our deepest intention when we are distracted. And we all know those bodhisattva vows, for example, that we chant. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are endless, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. But what are your vows, your personal vows? How do you want your life to unfold now? What is most precious, important for your life? What will you give? How will you give this life? In the Vimalakirti Sutra, the paramitas are discussed 23 times. I did a word check. And we could spend the rest of our retreat talking about the paramitas of perfections, the bodhisattva practices of generosity, morality, patience, energy, meditation, wisdom. And these too are skillful means to help us actualize our bodhisattva vows. And there's all kinds of lists in the Buddhist tradition. We could go on. But how do you practice skillful means right now on the cushion, as we walk to the dining hall, as we eat our meals, as you rest, as you meet a teacher in the Dzogchen room? Well, one way, I think, is to cultivate mindfulness, awareness, an intentionally focused mind, present and composed, open and fresh, over and over again, meeting this moment. I was thinking, you know, sometimes skillful means is hard to determine. So maybe it's easier to consider what is unskillful. This is kind of easier, really. And maybe a number of things kind of spring to mind. Like repeatedly telling your kids not to watch so much TV. Or repeatedly telling your kids, don't eat so much junk food. Or clean up your bedroom. Stay away from drugs. Or maybe you repeatedly tell yourself these things. Unskillful means doing the same thing over and over, but expecting different results. Right? How many times do you have to tell you? I remember my mother saying, how many times do I have to tell you to pick up blah, 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 blah? You think my mother would have learned? You think we would have learned, right? How many times do you tell yourself, right, to do something and you keep doing it? That's not skillful. So maybe we can ask ourselves something like, am I able to speak and act from more than simply my concerns, my views, my reactions? Am I able And if not, maybe just to be quiet, to be still is appropriate at that moment, until you are able to see and act from more than just one's own views and concerns. I think the practice of skillful means reminds us to listen deeply to others respectfully, honor the differences, and recognize that others may have different needs and benefit from different teachings, practices than the ones we do. As Kate mentioned in her talk, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, listens to the myriad cries of the world. And she, in some forms, carries all these myriad tools in her 1,000 arms and hands to give aid, whatever aid is needed for that moment. So we learn various useful approaches, and we learn to trust something bigger than ourselves. And from that place, respond with whatever is at hand. I believe our upaya grows and develops as we offer it to the world. And I was thinking, you know, I started this talk saying I don't like making mistakes. Perhaps even what we call mistakes are skillful means, because they awaken us to the present moment. Kind of like, you know, the shattering of glass brings us right into this moment. If you're distracted, vague, sleepy, make a mistake. See if that wakes you up a little. Mistakes are perfect jewels of insight. Because whether they bring regret, frustration, laughter, anger, or sadness, they often open us up in some new way if we let them. And I've discovered over many years of practice, the only place I can truly live my life is in the present moment. It took many years to realize this. I was always trying to live my life somehow in the future, right? You ever notice that? Like you're eating one cookie and you're thinking of how many cookies are left, right? Or you get your bowl of gruel that is really tasty, and you're thinking, will there be some left as it comes back? So it takes a long time to learn. You can only live in the present moment. And mistakes startle. They awaken me to the present. In some way, they can be an unexpected gift that brings us back to life. Thank you for your practice, for listening to this talk. And I'd like to encourage you to please reflect on your intention of being here. Give yourself to the schedule, the practice, as clearly as you can. But at the same time, don't push. Rest in the practice. And just trust. There is nothing special you need to do. There's no special place. You're already here. And that goes for people on Zoom too. You are already here. So let us continue to practice. And I think we're going to have some time outdoors. So let the great Dharma, the outside Dharma, enter your eyes and ears. Thank you.